Okay. Welcome to Tate. I'm Gabriela Salgado, Curator of Public Programs. It gives me great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Glenn Ligon, an artist based in New York, who will be in conversation with Patricia Vickers, the editor of Art Monthly. This is part of a series of very interesting conversations we are holding here at Tate, and we've been doing it for about a year now. So I invite you to just pay attention to the green leaflet there and look for the next events, which are coming in the next 2 months. But now to the event tonight. Glenn Ligon was born in the Bronx in 1960 and lives and works in New York City. His practice encompasses painting, sculpture, installation, photography, and digital media. Much of his work weaves an exploration of text into investigations of race, identity, and sexuality. His work forms part of museums' collections worldwide, including Tate and MoMA. And he has exhibited internationally in group and solo shows, including Powerhouse in Memphis in 2008, Tate Modern in 2007, MoMA New York in 1996, Institute of Contemporary Art in London in 1995, and the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York in 1994. We will conduct a conversation, and after that you'll have the opportunity to ask questions. So I hope you enjoy the event, and thank you for coming.
Coming, and thank you very much, Glenn, for agreeing to this talk.
Thank you.
I first encountered your work at Double Take, which was at the Hayward Gallery in 1992.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me now?
It's sort of echoes.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Big red tin can.
A red tin can. But if you can stand the echo a little bit until they fix it. no is the answer, you can't.
Well.
Perhaps I should lower my voice.
Okay, we're talking.
Yeah.
You still hear an echo. I hear an echo.
I'm laughing and you can still hear an echo.
And it wasn't the pint I had before the lecture.
White wine spritzer in my case.
Okay, we have to keep talking echoing, yeah. So we should just talk.
Yes, exactly. Well, I first saw your work in Double Take, and that was from the Dream series, which we can come back to later. And then soon after that, you were in a show at the ICA, in which you showed one of my favorite works, which is Rumble, Young Man, Rumble, which was a punch bag. And again, we'll come back to that. But and I wanted to have a long talk with you all those years ago, and it's taken all this time. But thankfully, Glenn, whose work should be known even more than it is in this country, is now represented by a gallery in London. So hopefully we're going to see more of Glenn in the coming year. But you emerged, sorry, like a butterfly from a chrysalis, you emerged in 1980s, and that was a period in which appropriation was the sort of dominant mode, and it was quintessentially a sort of postmodern critique of issues like authenticity, originality, authorship. But I'm not alone in thinking that in your work, although you use quotation and appropriation, it's not precisely a critique, although of course it contains critique, that it's more, as Wayne Bywalt, if that's the right pronunciation, put it rather elegantly, it's about the presence of the past in the present. And I think that was a beautiful way of putting it, and it struck me originally as so valuable that you brought history, not just because I'm an art historian by trade, but you brought history always into the mix, into the present, because you emerged at a time when Francis Fukuyama was famously declaring history was dead. Did you feel a kind of mission almost to reinstate history, the importance of histories, I should say?
Well, I think the beginning of my text work was about as Wayne said in the quote, about this sort of idea of bringing the past to the present. But I think in a way, I was certainly looking at what one would call appropriation artists and thinking about their work. But I think in some ways you have to have a text be known before you can deconstruct it. And so my approach to text in the early paintings was really about making the text known first. I remember a kind of formative moment. I was in the Whitney Museum Independent Study Program, which is a kind of post-grad school program for young artists. And I was sharing a studio with someone who was working on photographs by Charcot. So very deeply into psychoanalytic theory and sort of making work about that. And this was beyond my comprehension. So my studio mate asked me what I was working on. I said, well, I'm not really working on anything because I've got too much reading in this program to do. But I have been, as a sort of, you know, palate cleanser, I've been reading these James Baldwin essays. And she said, well, who's that? And I thought, ah, here's the problem. Is not so much that she had never read Baldwin, a lot of people hadn't read Baldwin, but the fact that the name was totally unfamiliar to her. And a name which I thought, you know, in an American context was canonical, since the early 50s, writing very sort of cogently about race relations and American identity. And so the fact that that name was unknown, totally unknown, was in a way for me a sort of prompt, a way into thinking about what my painting practice might be. And I think, you know, I'm fairly literal, as opposed to literary, I'm fairly literal, in that when I started using text for paintings, I don't know if I thought that that's what I was going to do. I was looking at things like Jasper Johns, I was looking at Rauschenberg, I was looking at people who had some kinds of texts in their paintings, looking at Twombly. And I thought, well, how do I get these things that I'm reading, these Baldwin essays, or Zora Neale Hurston, or Walt Whitman, or Genet, how do I get those ideas from those kinds of texts into the work? And I just thought, well, I'll just put them in there. And the work became about, in part, that use of that text and how that text appeared in the paintings. And but it touched on these questions of authorship, too, because there's this sort of, the early paintings always had this sort of address to the viewer, the I feel most colored, you know, I'm an invisible man. So there was a sort of presumption by the viewer that the text was being written by the person that made the painting, even though it was quotation.
You ceded authorship in a sense, and also the I wasn't you. So that was a very generous outgoing strategy. You were reaching out. Nevertheless, you were doing it in a form that was apparently rather difficult. People have used the word difficult. Darby English talks in his essay on you as difficulty. And it seemed to me that straight away you decided to complicate the issues or re-complicate the issues. We were talking earlier about sort of first, second generation feminism or gender studies, where in a way there's an act of recuperation. And within that, there's recuperating James Baldwin, who should have been known but wasn't. But in a way, as your sort of third and or fourth, perhaps your fourth, I'm third generation, in a sense, the act of recuperation was done by an earlier generation. And although there was still work to do, you could be much more critical, more ambivalent. You could accept ambiguity in the sources you used. Would you agree that that was a shift?
Well, I think, yeah, because certainly other people had been inspired by someone like Baldwin and had made work in relationship to his essays, his writings. Maybe not directly text-based in the way I was using, but it seemed like, as you said, we were at a different moment, and I was coming up in this moment when text was being used in particular kinds of ways, and so I'm looking at Sherry Levine, and I'm looking at... Sherry Levine's not a good example, but I'm looking at Barbara Kruger, I'm looking at Jenny Holzer, and thinking about the strategies that they employ in their work. But I'm very, at the same time, very invested in painting. And so saying we're talking about the mid late 80s, where they're in New York, there's a sort of distance from painting. There's, you know, there's a lot of painting going on, but the text work that I'm looking at, in a way, is a critique of painting, critique of this sort of aura of originality and stuff. So all of those things get or influence this into why I'm using quotation, why the paintings, the early paintings, have this very systematic approach to them, a sentence repeated over and over again, and that's from Saul LeWitt, you know. So so I sort of felt like very early on it was very important to me to be in dialogue with the things that were happening around me, as well as in dialogue with work that had come before.
And that, so again, that's another layer of history. But repetition doesn't just extend to the use of repeated phrases, which are overlaid over and over and over again, and we can talk about the stenciling technique later, but also, as Judd always said, there need not be a linear history. You can return to works. You don't have to constantly go on to something different, that you could actually, and you do. For instance, I'm thinking of the Million Man March series that you've returned to periodically. And that's also a way of denying some kind of linear trajectory, but also offering the opportunity to the viewer as well as yourself to rethink your situation vis-a-vis a work you made earlier, a position you might have held earlier.
Well, I think I'm always interested in having a practice that is a bit more complicated than simply a painting practice, which is maybe not good for my career, but it's good for my mental health. Because I think it's, you know, at a certain point, you painting is boring. And so you sort of need to move on to other things. But I'm always deeply interested in making paintings. And so these other projects, I think initially were a way to get myself away from the painting practice and try other things, just, you know. But I think now they're more integrated. I'm realizing that the investigations that happen in the painting or an investigation that happened in a neon or a video are related. They're different because the, you know, the material is different, but they're all kind of related. So I think if I had a more sort of linear practice, I am a painter and this is what I do, that maybe some of these investigations would have been quote unquote finished earlier. But it's interesting for me to still be using oil stick and stencils after all these years and to find something new out of that.
But the use of a stencil has an obvious distance, it's an obviously distancing device. And in that sense, people have linked it with minimalism in that it's a pre-existing form, but somehow, although it's a stenciling is very impersonal. The layered use of it, the blurring, the smudging, the makes it very painterly again, and makes it somehow seem very personal. So you've squared the circle again. You've made painting that's text. You've made painting that's apparently distance that becomes very personal and very textual and sensuous. What led you to add the glittering coal dust to the mix?
I think it was in sort of thinking again about Baldwin. He's sort of a key figure in this work. If you've ever read any of Baldwin's essays, particularly the essays, sometimes in the novels, he's very, he writes like a preacher. He was a boy preacher. And so there are these very long kind of Proustian sentences. But the subject matter that he's dealing with, an essay that I've used a lot in paintings, is called Stranger in the Village, and it's a sort of document of his time spent in Switzerland in the mid-50s. And he's trying to deal with a lot of stuff in that essay, his relationship to America, the fact of being a stranger in Europe, his relationship to colonialism and European history, the sort of fear and fascination that a stranger in any context creates. And, all of that's in a 10-page essay. And so the sort of gravity and weight and the sort of panoramic nature of that work inspired me, again, literally, to think about how to make the text, use that text in a way that reflected that somehow. And the addition of the coal dust seemed to me to do that, because it literally bulked up the text. And at the same time, it made it more sort of attractive. It's shiny, it's very beautiful material, but it's a waste product.
You say quite often, and I've noticed in other interviews, you've said that you're literal minded, and that that metaphor comes subsequently, that metaphors flood in. And yet, to the viewer, the metaphorical layering of the work is so rich. The moment you even start thinking about, I mean, one of my favorite works, I was saying to you earlier, with your work, I feel I can say this, one of my favorite works is work I haven't actually seen. And I say this as someone who normally insists on the importance of seeing work. But such is the conceptual strength of the work. The work is untitled and Untitled Contact. This is a, in case you don't know it, it's a very heavily worked oil stick work. And before the oil stick dried, a sort of virgin canvas, a naked white canvas, was pressed against it. So, and it left an impression. And this sticky contact, which is incredibly sensuous, but it's also metaphorical, it's sexual, but it's also the white canvas, the black surface, how we are intermixed. And this ambiguity is something you've always allowed in your work, encouraged, this reading. There is no single reading, there is no... You constantly deal with black and white and constantly merge it.
But I think, you know, I started using black text on white canvases because that's the way it appears in books. So it has taken on this sort of racialized meaning, but I think for me it was simply, you know, that's how it appears. And that painting in particular, again, uses this Baldwin essay, Stranger of the Village, and that was part of a cycle of paintings that were done for Documenta 11 in 2002. And that painting was interesting for me because it was, in some ways, trying to do, again, what the essay was doing, trying to do what the essay was talking about. This is about this contact between different things. And so taking one blank canvas and pressing it against another painting. But of course that makes a mirror because the text is backwards. And so that was interesting to me because a lot of what Baldwin talks about in that essay is this sort of question of mirroring, how he sees the villagers, how they look at him, and sort of uses them as a mirror to see himself. And so that's kind of what, you know, what that painting was about. But I really do think that all of that comes later, that really it comes from just experimenting and figuring out what things mean. And maybe this is why, as I said, I cycle back to things, because I'm slow. It takes me a while to figure out, you know, 3 or 4 years later, oh, that's what that was about, you know. And so then it sparks again this interest in kind of continuing that investigation.
Now, sometimes you return to things when times have changed. For instance, it was very interesting that you started to make the famous Richard Pryor joke works, joke paintings. And Richard Pryor, his live shows really skated on the edge. They were so daring, frightening. It was like a tightrope walk. And you made a series starting in 94 of Richard Pryor. And then you said in an interview that you backed off from them, you were scared. Could you say more about that? Because you came back to them. What led you back to them?
Well,
it's slightly different from just interrogating an earlier work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, the thing for me about those paintings was, if anyone knows Richard Pryor's routines, they're tough in lots of ways. They are critiques of American society. They're critiques of sexuality. They're very harsh, jokes. And so the initial series was shown in a exhibition at the Whitney Museum called Blackmail, which is representations of masculinity in contemporary art. And a funny thing happened in that show, which was a friend who was a docent at the Whitney was giving a tour, and the jokes are rather small, and a lot of them have the word nigger in them. And he didn't feel comfortable reading these jokes aloud. But because the paintings were so small, the audiences, the groups, the tours were so large, he was giving a tour, and from the back of the audience, people just kept saying, read the joke. Like that just kept being shouted out, because they literally could not read. They were too far away. And he kept, you know, being a good docent, talking about issues of narration and text and art and things like that. And from the back, read the joke, read the joke. And he said that finally someone pushed their way to the front, pushed him aside, read the joke, and all hell broke loose, because this was supposed to be a show about the representation of black men in contemporary art and text with, you know, nasty Richard Pryor jokes. Don't you like Richard Pryor? I love Richard Pryor at home, on my stereo, not on the walls of the Whitney Museum. And so what was interesting for me about that was, and maybe this is a side thing, this in some ways had nothing to do with the paintings, but maybe has something to do with my reticence about the series, is that that kind of half an hour debate where they pushed the docents aside happened because of those paintings and because of the issues that were brought up in those paintings. And it was almost too much for me. And so I backed away from them. But I think, you know, looking back at Pryor, years later, when I started sort of listening to his routines again and thinking, oh, there's very interesting critiques of masculinity in here, incredible political critiques, and it seemed very timely suddenly, even though those jokes were mainly from the mid-70s. They seemed right now. You know, if Pryor can make a joke about, you know, having gay sex in the mid-70s, you think about that, that's the moment when the dominant representations are Shaft and Superfly, these sort of images of hyper-masculinity. And so I thought that was a really interesting to return to that, you know, in this moment when rap and hip-hop, those kinds of images have returned. So,
But it was so interesting what one of the person who pushed to the front saying that, I don't mind Richard Pryor at home, but in this public sphere. And in a way, there's an analogy with a work you made to Embark. Disembark, yeah. Sorry. Where it's almost about Henry Box Brown, who boxed himself in a crate and had himself transported to it was an escape routine. He escaped by having himself boxed and posted and to freedom in Philadelphia. Amazingly courageous thing to do. And you made a series of these boxes to the same dimensions as part of an installation. And observers have said it's about sort of smuggling yourself, the black artist, into the museum, if you like. There is an element where there's a kind of parallel with when a black artist is in a museum, what does that mean? What did you have to do to get there?
Well,
do you agree with that interpretation?
I think that work came out of the paintings in some ways, because the paintings were so much interested in voice. And one of the things that I was curious about when I read Henry Box Brown was a slave in a tobacco factory in Richmond, Virginia, and so he mailed himself, or was mailed in this crate, to an anti-slavery society in Philadelphia, and this was in 1815. Mm-hmm. I'm bad at dates, 49, I think. When I was reading this narrative, I realized, well, one of the things that would have given him away as he was being mailed in this crate for 25 hours was voice. And so that sort of sparked this whole sort of train of thought about what does it mean to speak and what does it mean not to speak. And so it sort of dovetailed with, I think, the text work that I was doing. But also I think my work in some ways is autobiography, but autobiography always filtered through other people's narratives, so other people's texts. And so using Henry Box Brown's narrative as a way to generate that piece was a way of thinking about, you know, this connection between this person's story and my story. Not to say that they are the same, but to draw those, tease out those sort of connections. So I think that maybe I was less concerned about the sort of critique of the museum in the way that someone like Fred Wilson has used material like that as a way to sort of critique the unspoken narratives of the museum. I think it's less about that and more about this sort of question of voice and where does voice appear and disappear.
There's a, actually, you were talking about early text pieces, and there's a wonderful one of the, I said we'll get back to those dream book paintings, and that's what I saw, of course, in the Double Take show. And one in particular, if I can find it here, bear with me a moment, where the people might not know, and I certainly didn't until I saw the show, that these dream books were used in the numbers game, that interpretations of dreams, a word association and what was associated with that type of dream, each one had a number, a three-digit number. And this was used in the illegal numbers game, which was a kind of illegal lottery. So black people were basically betting on their dreams. And it's a very much a Native American culture, isn't it? And there was one in particular which was about voice. I'm determined to find it here because I won't remember it. It was number 333. Don't worry, I haven't got to go through 3302.
I mean, it's not so different. You mean, people bet their kids' ages and their house numbers and things like that. But what interested me was it sort of, these dream books implied a whole kind of set of knowledge that were based on, you know. But also, you know, there's a sort of secret autobiography thing in there because my father was a numbers runner, partially. I mean, he worked for General Motors as a, but, you know, side money.
I saw so many gangster movies with number running, and I never knew what it was about until I saw your
work. It's just betting
work.
On the, you know, illegal betting. That's all it is.
Really. The one I was looking for is Speechless, number 348. To dream that you are unable to speak is a sign of adversity and shame. To regain your voice denotes others will no longer speak for you. So this idea of being forcibly silenced, of the suppressed voice, you've returned to that many times. Sometimes you blot it out yourself with over-stenciling, and you blot it out yourself, that you don't always enable the voice. On the contrary, sometimes you deliberately obscure the words or silence the voice yourself, but then perhaps you have the right to do that.
Well, it's the difficulty you talked about earlier, people have alluded to in kind of the reading of the work. But I think that kind of obscuring and that difficulty is about some of the issues you're talking about that sort of started in that dream book work. And that was maybe the first, not quite the first, but kind of the nearly the first text work I was doing. But I think, you know, I think the text in my work is often difficult to read because the ideas in the text are difficult. Yeah. And so that struggle to read is a parallel to what those texts are about. Mm. The difficulty of, again, Baldwin trying to decipher his place in the world. Mm. These are, you know, it's hard to make that explicit. It's hard to explain that. And so I think in some ways the difficulty of the text is about that. But also, I think, you know, Google, I mean, these things are available. And there is a sort of interesting anxiety about text not being legible that's curious to me. Text demands to be read. And so it's being frustrated, the sort of failure of language, and that frustration is, I think an interesting to sort of stage that for to make the viewer frustrated that there's not an easy access to any kind of explanation of culture or identity or anything like that. That it's work.
Saying, yes, it's work. You were saying earlier that the work is autobiographical in a way, but you refuse the. I was saying earlier that you refuse the I. It's not. You've said in an interview that you resisted solipsism, that you don't want to refer only to yourself. So, it's interlarded with other people's. In fact, how can we ever know someone? And you overlay this with other people's narratives, interlarded with your own. And that's very much the case in the website piece you did that was based on the photo album commissioned by Deer. I do recommend you look this up on the web. It works extremely well. And it's called, and they're singing on it, Glenn Ligon singing. A cappella it's called in a press release I read somewhere, which is a very dignified term.
Bad discos.
I particularly treasure you singing YMCA. But it's as a photo album. It's called Annotations, so it's easily found on the web. And you click on each photo, and the suppression, the suppressed images emerge, suppressed ideas, scrawls on the back of photographs, not necessarily on the one you've clicked on, little autobiographical passages about your school days, or and singing, and also hidden images, pornographic, erotic images. And this idea that the photo album is how we understand ourselves.
Right. Yeah, it's where the family represents itself. And so, but in that representation, I'm always interested in the sort of things that cannot be said in the space of the photo album that may be known if you're in the family, like, oh, that's Uncle so-and-so's friend, you know?
Yes.
In quotes.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's not spoken about, but it's there. Yes. But it's, and so part of that project was about sort of unveiling those things by having, you know, the notes, basically.
Yes. Yes.
Like clicking on an image and it bringing you to a text or another set of images that don't necessarily explain what you're seeing, but give you some sense of background and context. And you know, the project is half found photographs and half family photographs. So there's